1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the March 15th, 2022 meeting of the House Taxes Committee to order under House Rules 10.01. And again, for those watching these proceedings, if you want to get all of the information that we have, please go on your website to the House of Represent Minnesota House of Representatives. Go to committees and divisions, then go to taxes committee, and then that home page off to the right-hand side will be all of those materials. So with that, Ms. Griska, please call the roll.
Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Marquardt present. Representative Liz Lagarde excused. Representative Davids.
Davids present.
Representative Davids present. Representative Agbaje. Representative Agbaje present. Representative Carlson.
Carlson's present.
Representative Carlson's present. Representative Detmer.
Detmer present.
Representative Detmer present. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo present.
Representative Garofalo present. Representative Gomez.
Gomez present.
Representative Gomez present. Representative Herr.
Herr present.
Representative Herr present. Representative Hertas.
Hertas present.
Representative Hertas present. Representative Howard.
Howard present.
Representative Howard present. Representative McDonald.
McDonald present.
Representative McDonald present. Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Miller present. Representative Moran.
Present.
Representative Moran present. Representative Mortensen.
Mortensen present.
Representative Mortensen present. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Robbins present. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Representative Sandell present. Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Schultz present. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Stevenson present. Representative Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Swazinski present. Representative Joachim.
Joachim present.
Representative Joachim present. We have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Ms. Griska. Also, want to give members attention to a referred memo to the property tax division that was posted. So members, we have two bills today that the chair plans to lay over both of those. And the first bill is House File 3982. Representative Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move my bill.
I also see, Representative Howard, you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move the A1 amendment and can briefly describe it if you'd like.
Let's do that. We will approve that. And after this bill, we'll come back to minutes. I just moving so quickly here, I forgot the minutes again. But we're going to deal with this bill and we can come back and do that. So, Representative Howard, the A1 amendment, there's a lot to it. But what I would like you to do is I'd like members to adopt this amendment so that when you speak to the bill and you can put it in order, you can have the amendment incorporated. So, members, if that's all right, I'd like to approve and adopt the amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author then can explain the bill. So members, I'll call for a vote on the A1 amendment. Temporarily unmute yourself. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say aye. Nay. The motion does prevail. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Howard, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As you know, in every corner of this state and everywhere in between, our communities and our constituents are facing significant housing challenges. Statewide, we are not producing or preserving enough housing that is affordable. And according to a deeply reported story by the Star Tribune just last year, Minnesota has the worst housing shortage in the country. And while the challenges are immense, no matter where you are in the state, those challenges can be unique depending where in the state you are. In the metro area, we're seeing a pronounced shortage of available housing that meets the needs of our lowest income Minnesotans. In suburban communities, we're seeing a shortage of affordable single family homes, also the loss of naturally occurring affordable housing, which is leading to displacement and higher rents. In greater Minnesota, we're seeing a huge need for workforce housing, both multifamily and single family. And really the end result of this huge supply demand mismatch is higher prices for homes and higher rents, and the reality that 500,000 Minnesotans are cost burdened, meaning they're paying more than 30% of their income in their housing. This housing shortage is hurting our economy, it's hurting our local communities, and it's hurting Minnesotans. The answer to solving our housing crisis in Minnesota is recognizing that there cannot just be one answer. We do need to recognize that the status quo has not and will not meet this challenge. And we need to think outside the box and provide new approaches to help meet our community needs. And that is what this bill represents. This bill would create local housing affordability aid, providing a new direct resource directly to Minnesota cities and counties across the state so that they can utilize resources to address unique housing needs specific to their community. We know that our cities and our counties understand their community best, but the reality is they lack the resources to take on this problem with any sort of scale. They don't need our help to understand the problem or tell them where to spend the resources, but they do need resources. And so how this housing aid would work is we'd create a formula-based aid that goes to every Minnesota county, cities over 10,000 in population, and with this amendment we adopted, is available to smaller cities across the state as well. Using a formula based on cost-burdened households, we would provide housing aid to cities and counties and a flexible source of resources so that, say, in Thief River Falls, a community could use it to build needed workforce housing. A community in the metro area might use it for gap financing to help a deeply affordable housing project move forward. The point is we're providing flexible resources. The benefits of approach like this are many. Number one and most important, we're providing more funding. And that's so needed right now. As a reminder for members, the general fund budget for the Minnesota Housing Finance Authority, our main state agency that helps fund housing, is 0.3% of our general fund. We also use housing infrastructure bonds, but the department has traditionally said no to three out of four projects. Our resources are not meeting the need. Second, these resources, there's no RFP process for cities and counties here. They would receive resources and invest them directly where they know best. And third, as I mentioned, they're flexible so that we can provide a path for cities and counties to address the range of housing needs in our state, from deeply affordable rental to home ownership to workforce housing. Now I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers who can help provide a little more lay of the land on the housing challenges in our state. And we can hear from cities and counties who can do a better job than I, the folks that are in the trenches every day and know the challenge that they're facing in their community and can describe what a proposal like this would mean for their communities in our state. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Representative Howard, for explaining the reason for the bill and then going over the provisions of the bill. And before we go forward, I do want to mention the revenue estimate, and this is House File 3982 as now amended by the A1 amendment. So for 2024, the general fund total would be 96.72 million, and also in 2025, 96.72 million. There's a $100 million of housing aid and grant appropriation each year, but with the property tax refund interaction and so forth, an income tax interaction, it moves it down a little bit less than $100 million. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a question for Representative Howard. You'd mentioned the amendment that in the original bill went down to cities of 10,000. What did the amendment do? What's the level now? I mean, 10,000, I call a metropolis. If they've got a McDonald's, they're bigger than any cities I represent. So what did it go down to?
Representative Howard, how does that work now for smaller cities?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Davids. What the amendment does is create 10 million of this 100 million in yearly aid that would be available for any city, a city of any size to apply for to receive a grant. And just in way of a little background here, when we looked at providing formula-based aid for the kinds of production that we're looking at, you do reach a point where if you're giving a city a couple thousand dollars, there isn't really a whole lot that they could really do with that. It might not even be worth the staff time. But maybe once every couple years, there's a pretty significant project in a smaller city where a resource like this could help them complete an important project in their community. So what we do is we create basically a pot of resources that cities of any size can apply for so that smaller cities can take advantage of this aid.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Rep. Howard.
Very good. And kind of in line with what Chair Davis is asking, just if you want to explain how the dollars that go out to the counties, Representative Howard, how can that be dispersed or how can counties use those dollars that would go out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the breakdown, 70 million would go out to counties, 20 to the larger cities, and then 10 million would go out and be available to smaller cities. Posted online, you will see a breakdown or a run, so you can members can check and see what their county, their city might receive. And I encourage folks to check in with your local elected officials and get a sense of what they might use this for. We did create the uses for these funds are defined in the bill, but they are fairly flexible. You know, they can be used for gap financing. They can be used for the acquisition, demolition, rehab, or construction. They do have income limits attached to them, but again, that are pretty flexible to create housing that is for renters at 80% area median income for single family home at 115% of area median income. And loosely, some of these, the parameters are based off of the Challenge Program operated through Minnesota Housing. And that was an intentional. It's a program that provides flexible resources and is well known by counties and cities. So we feel by creating this flexible pot in a recognizable source, that makes it easier for cities and counties to understand how to utilize these funds in a way that fits the needs in their community.
Well, thank you, Representative Howard. And the aid distribution amounts that Representative Howard is referring to have now been changed to reflect the amendment, because I see 70 million going to the counties now instead of the 80. So, Representative Howard, thank you. I mean, I know you've put a lot of thought and time into this proposal. So if when the county gets the dollars, could they give those dollars to a city or even a township potentially if they had a housing concern? How does that work? I mean, are they restricted to where they would be able to provide those dollars to?
Mr. Chair, they're not restricted. We did include some language that we want to encourage counties to work with cities. Presumably a county is going to partner with a local municipality for any of these. And we feel that the more sort of collaboration, the better. The part of the idea of providing that aid to the cities at 10,000 and greater, those cities are more likely to have the kind of robust economic development or HRA staff. A smaller city might not sort of have that technical expertise on staff, and that's where a county would be able to bring more sort of expertise and resources to bear and partner with a smaller city to move a project forward.
Very good. Thank you so much. So, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, can you hear me okay?
We can.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, thank you for bringing this bill forward today. As I think you know, City of St. Paul right now is going through pretty tough situation with regards to their rent control initiative that's being enacted. How would your bill interact with that?
Representative Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, it wouldn't.
Representative Groffel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, it has to, because that's what the municipal ordinance is right now, and that's affecting, it's dramatically impacting housing supply in the city of St. Paul. So you have a formula that's in place here. We're having, I mean, it's, I assume that you are familiar with what's been going on in St. Paul, Representative Howard, is that with regards to rent control and the effects of it?
Representative Howard?
I apologize for being a little glib with my response. The resources that would flow to, say, Ramsey County or the city of St. Paul are not specifically tied in any way to those local provisions. They would be able to use these flexible resources to meet community needs on a range of issues.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Groffalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard. But they would not be able to be used on a property, whether it was new or existing, unless they obeyed the municipal ordinance on rent control, right?
Representative Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I believe a fair amount of the projects that cities and counties would look and we can look to, and we can hear from some of them, are going to be prospective. You know, the kinds of things of how do we provide the gap financing to move a project forward that meets a community need. And so in that vein, they'd be partnering and working through this sort of development process, and or would it be a, you know, a nonprofit developer to help preserve an existing naturally occurring affordable housing unit. So there's a variety of flexible needs that a city or a county could use and work with to address.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, yes, I understand the program and I understand the initiative, but in a place like St. Paul right now, the financing, private sector financing, has dried up as a result of the uncertainty in the market. And so it would seem to me this would be a really good opportunity to engage with the city of St. Paul if this bill were to go forward, to say, hey, projects that are funded with this money are exempt from this ordinance. I know they've been talking about how new construction may be exempted from it. I mean, candidly, no one knows what the heck is going on in St. Paul. We just know there's a lot of damage happening to that market there. So it sounds like there hasn't really been a lot of talk about integrating that, using this as a tool to try to fix that problem in St. Paul. But Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. At this time, I think we will move on to our testifiers. And the first one is Ann Mabody, Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership. And I think you have a presentation to make also. Is that true? And if you'd please welcome to the committee if you'd introduce yourself.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Ann Mabody. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. And I'm here to speak in favor of House File 3982. And really, because of the great need that local communities have to have additional resources to invest in affordable housing. And to really, what's essential, so essential really, is that these local governments can make sure that they identify their own needs and then have the resources to address them. One of the things that Minnesota Housing Partnership does is works throughout Minnesota in rural communities and doing exactly that in assisting communities. I'm gonna share some slides, and I'm gonna go through them very quickly. Hopefully you have a copy on file that everyone can look at and review and ask questions about later, because I'm going to go quickly. Hang on 1 second.
Sounds like a good plan. Thank you.
Okay. Let me see if I can share my screen. Nope. I am sorry. 1 minute. There we go. And
there we
let
go.
Me play from the start. Here we go. So, first of all, I just want to say we are short in housing throughout Minnesota. And we are catching up from the recession back in 2006, where we underproduced the housing that our community needs to support job growth, to support kids staying in schools, all the things we need housing for. And so now we're in a moment where we need to overproduce. And that is true for every corner of the state. So when you look at multifamily permits that have been pulled throughout the state, that is just not enough housing development to keep up with the kinds of growth, both for population and jobs that we need. One example, I've been talking recently to Marvin Windows. They are projecting just in War Road, Minnesota, that they need more than 300 units of housing in the next 3 years. And based on what our supply is producing now, it's just not enough. And it's not just housing that's not enough, because we need every kind of housing in every corner of the state, but we particularly need housing that's affordable to all these jobs that are those lower, the jobs that pay lower wages, but are essential. And what this particular chart shows is that of the current distribution of what the market actually produces, the dark blue is the 80% income levels and above, the higher income folks. And that's what the market is really playing to. Only about a couple hundred units a year that are affordable to the folks that are taking care of our kids and taking care of my mom and doing those essential jobs, only a couple hundred units a year are being produced when we need so many more units created. And it's something that the market is not doing without additional resources. The other piece is, in addition to producing, we need to preserve housing. So what we see here is the aging of housing, both for multifamily and single family. And it is throughout the state where this housing is aging. It needs reinvestment and preservation in every corner of the state. And so we talk about naturally occurring affordable housing. And you can see from these bubble maps where these older buildings, I call them hardworking housing for hardworking folks. It's in every corner of this state that we need to preserve housing. And this is market housing that's aging, where local governments could have an essential role in identifying those projects to preserve. But also a lot of these projects that had been federally funded previously, like through low-income housing tax credits or through the rural program that produces section through 515 projects that are essential to our rural communities. These are 4-unit projects, 10-unit projects, but sometimes the only affordable housing for our lowest income folks in rural areas. So all that preservation needs to happen, and we don't have enough housing to do it. We also know, as Representative Howard noted, that we have over 500,000 households that are cost burdened. They are paying more for their housing than they can afford because of that market squeeze. And again, this is happening throughout Minnesota. In every corner of the state, folks are paying way too much for their housing than what they can actually afford. And that is both limiting job growth, it's impinging on family stability and and community strength as well. And of course, can't talk about housing unless we talk about the racial disparities within housing, and from home ownership, where you're half as likely to own a home if you're a person of color than a white household, and you're paying more for your housing and experiencing homelessness more if you're people of color. And this is what local communities know best on how to address those local demands and local needs. So all of you, we are grateful that previously you had created and supported the local housing trust fund investments and other kinds of investments that are empowering these local communities. But really, this is, we need to reset and reevaluate what our minimum amounts of state funding into housing is. And so we need to scale it up to demand to support our families and support our businesses.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mavity. Very good information. I appreciate that. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Question for our testifier, Ms. Mavity. I think we all can appreciate your enthusiasm for housing. I can hear it in your voice and your passion. You certainly were glad that you're doing the good work that you are. Kind of a follow-up on Representative Garofalo's concerns regarding St. Paul. Because of their new cap on their rent control, housing building permits are down 80%. And there was two projects for 260 units that were ready to go with financing, but the investment was pulled because of the rent control that St. Paul established. clear the evidence is rent control reduces affordable housing and affordable housing, and it's certainly a failed procedure and policy. And it's evident in just the St. Paul's 80% permits down. What's your thoughts on that regarding the rent?
Representative McDonald, what is your question? It cut out at the end. I didn't hear what your question was.
My question was, with her passion and expertise in the industry, knowing that this bill most likely help going forward with affordable housing, what's her thoughts on rent control, knowing that St. Paul building permits are down 80% and that two projects have pulled with a total of 260 units?
Let me answer that in a way. If you could answer that in relation to House File 3982.
Exactly. Yes, I will. So thank you for that. And what I would say is, because I know that this committee or other committees have had lots of discussions about rent control, so I'm not going to go down into that detail. Happy to talk offline with you about that as well. What I would say is, every local community adopts a number of different housing policies and approaches to housing, whether it's inclusionary housing policies or targeting to home ownership or what the two cities, central cities, have done on rent control. These resources, I think, are agnostic about what all those local priorities are happening around the state. What we know is that local communities are around the state need more resources to address those issues that they have identified locally as their priorities.
Representative McDonald.
Well, I won't get into debate here, but I would disagree with you, contraire, that these precious resources were there already, but because of St. Paul's idiotic rent control policy, they left. So it is very important in a very encyclical relationship between individual municipalities and their decisions on affordable housing. So I would encourage you to take a look at that a little closer and ensure that in order to pass this legislation, that cities don't put a nail in the coffin, if you will, to begin with.
Thank you. Next up testifying, we have Olmsted County Commissioner Sheila Kiskaden. Commissioner. Is the Commissioner Kiskaden?
Oh, she's muted.
There she is. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Commissioner, please introduce yourself for the committee and begin your testimony.
I think after 2 years, I would have that down, right? So, Sheila Kiskaden, I'm Olmsted County Commissioner, and I represent District 6. But I'm also very active on housing issues in our community and have been an advocate for housing through the Governor's Task Force on Housing in past years. I really want to thank the committee, and I want to thank Representative Howard for this bill, because I really think that it meets a need that we don't have. It creates a whole set of tools that local units of government can use that otherwise are not available. And as he developed this bill, I'm really here today not representing Olmsted County, I'm representing MICA, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the Association of Minnesota Counties. Both of those organizations have gotten much more engaged in looking at housing issues in the last several years, because just as you heard from the previous witness, the supply of housing is affecting every corner of the state. And at the same time, every community has its own set of needs. So I know you're going to hear from my colleague, I believe Jack Swanson from Roseau County will be on, and their housing needs around workforce are different than the housing needs that Representative Davis might have down in Preston. Did a housing tour down there last fall, Representative Davis, and heard about how that community is working very hard to create affordable housing in Preston, just as we are in Olmsted County with the cities in our area. It's very difficult. I've been surprised at how much housing requires flexibility and requires layering of funding to bring an affordable housing project forward. So in our particular area, we have really looked at, we've done a housing study, and we have five priority areas, but we don't necessarily have the funding or the flexibility to make it happen. So the real beauty of this bill is it provides a significant amount of money is sent directly to cities and counties where we can work with our local communities, whether they're the not-for-profit community, our HRAs, our employers, our advocates for the homeless, around what our needs are and how can we meet those needs in our community. An example for my community is we have a lot of nationally equitable affordable housing, but we have a lot of seniors living in them. We estimate that we need about 4,000, 5,000 units of senior housing, to affordable senior housing. If we can move seniors out of those three-bedroom ramblers in Milton Hills Drive, families can move in and they're going to be more affordable homes than can be built today. So we really need, we need that kind of flexibility. It allows, the bill that you have before you allows each community to look at what its specific needs are, what its assets are for dealing with their housing issue, or who they can partner with, and use those funds to meet the needs that they're ready to meet in their community on their particular needs. It also, I like the fact that there's accountability in this bill. So you have a kind of a clawback provision. If a local unit of government doesn't spend the funds that you've allocated to them, those funds will be returned and can be reallocated out to communities who really are able to move forward with housing. So I really think that this proposal advances housing and creates flexibility for the units of government that are most directly engaged on a day-to-day basis with our housing needs, with our residents. The cities, the counties, small cities, large cities, our needs are different. So this bill very much creates the tool that we don't have currently, will allow us to partner, will allow us to work on our local needs, will allow us to have flexible funding to plug gaps. You know, if we can get this much funding, but we have this gap, this will allow us to really meet our housing needs in a way that we currently cannot do. So I really, I think this could be a game changer for local units of government. And yeah, there might be a few places where you're concerned about the local decision making, but I would guess around the state, you know that the local units of government, whether counties or cities, really are the place where we engage with our community around our community's preferences and our community's needs, and we get it done. So please support this bill. This bill will really give us a tool that we badly need, and you have ways that you're going to hold us accountable. And we're ready to get to work, roll up our sleeves, and it's exciting. This option might be available for us to meet the needs of our communities. There. So thank you again, Representative Howard, and thank you for the committee members. I'm pleased to answer any questions should you have them, but both the Minnesota Intercounty Association and the Association of Minnesota Counties supports this bill.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Howard. According to the graphs that the testifier has presented today and the conversations I've had with people in our community in Woodbury, the market forces are so strong that encouraging the construction of higher income housing, I'm not sure how your bill is going to overcome them. And second of all, will the funding or the taxes, the tax transfers that you're talking about, be able to sustain the county's dedication to affordable housing?
Okay, Representative Howard, if you want to answer that, and then I think we're going to hear the remaining testifiers, and we can come back to questions for the author. But Representative Howard, to Representative Sandell's question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sandell, to your last question, this would provide 100 million yearly in ongoing resources to help to provide a consistent source of revenue for our cities and counties. And to the piece about affordability, of note, there are affordability parameters in the bill so that the resources would be utilized to help move forward development or preservation that is affordable, and our cities and counties could speak to this more. I think they will often see potential proposals to build housing that is affordable, but because of the market conditions, they don't necessarily pencil out. They need a gap financing of some kind to make the deals work. And so this resource could be used to help more of those projects move forward. And you're right, the market right now, the market is not supporting this. That's why we need something like this so that more affordable development can proceed.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Howard. I look forward to talking to you more about this. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Next testifier is Todd Prafke, City Administrator from the City of St. Peter. Mr. Prafke.
Mr. Chair, hopefully you can hear me.
There you are. We can hear you. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Todd Prafke. I'm the city administrator here in St. Peter. Thanks to you, Chair Marquardt, and the committee for letting me testify today. I'm here on behalf of the city of St. Peter and also the League of Minnesota Cities in support of House File 3982 as amended earlier in your meeting. Like many cities across the state, St. Peter has been focused on a lot of innovative opportunities over the last 50 to 20 years, really working towards affordable or workforce housing. I have to mention one thing that hasn't been mentioned that we see critically within St. Peter, that housing equates to economic development. Housing is economic development within St. Peter, and so I'd hate to have that lost as a part of this discussion. The city's used many local partnerships and many local efforts to address housing needs. And so we've done things from housing assistance for givable seconds, subdivision development. We built our own subdivisions. The city has been the developer. We've built houses for folks. We've done building rehab, both on the single family and multifamily front. There are projects, one of the projects that we had 13 different funding sources to get together for affordable housing within the community. And this would provide one other opportunity. We're doing everything that we can to assist with construction, preservation, rehabilitation, you name it. There are lots of things out there, and we're doing everything that we can, and any additional resources that we can get to help meet some of those gaps will be significant in moving this forward. We've partnered with local organizations. We've partnered with Minnesota Housing Finance. We've used CAP agencies like Minnesota Valley Action to help develop and administer programs for rehabilitation of housing stock, which is very, very important in greater Minnesota. Folks like Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and others have all participated in some of the projects that we've done. But we can't do it alone, and Minnesota Housing Finance has been wonderful in some of the programming. However, they have to look at it at such a scale and such a level that it can't always be individually tailored to what communities need. And our smallest communities, frankly, in Minnesota struggle with that the most, that their niche is very narrow, what they need is very narrow, and at times can't be encompassed in the programming that's done through Minnesota Housing Finance. It just can't. It's fantastic work, and we've utilized it so many times, but they just can't meet all those local initiatives that are in place. So $20 million in flexible funding, flexible, affordable funding aid is significant and really an important step in expanding. And so if we talk about $100 million a year, or $96 million a year, and however that's split among counties and local units and others, anything that we can add to that will have an impact, and the need is significant. Establishing a program like this for like St. Peter and other cities across the state can do more to attract new development, can do more to assist residents, whether it's down payment assistance or gap funding or whatever it is. One of the great things about this is that we can look at our data, we can find solutions to that, and we can have resources that address our specific solution, which has been mentioned by others, might not be the same as it is in Pipestone or Madison, or you pick the community. One last thing I'd like to mention is that it really is that ability to connect that local data with local partnered solutions and resources that at least from my perspective can be significant in the resources that are provided in this bill and help communities move forward. Again, not just on housing, but on economic development. Again, here for the City of St. Peter and the League of Minnesota Cities, and Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any questions that folks might have. We have done a tremendous amount in housing. Many of you have probably been to some of the projects that we've done in St. Peter, and so I'd be happy to share more about that and the gaps that we've seen in the past and how this might help.
Very good, Mr. Prafke. Thank you so much for your testimony. Our last testifier is Roseau County Commissioner Jack Swanson. Commissioner Swanson.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. We last saw each other, I think, in Ada a couple of summers ago.
That's
good to
right.
see your face again. Thank
well,
you.
Welcome for, to the for, committee. If you would introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you. My name is Jack Swanson. I'm a Roseau County Commissioner. I've served in this role since 2006. I appreciated the comments of the previous testifiers related to the flexibility around this bill, Representative Howard. So thank you for that. And to Sheila's point, there are different needs in different parts of the state. So in my part of Minnesota, what we need is market rate workforce housing. And I'll just give you a bit of background. Roseau County has about 16,000 people. We're, for those who don't know, on the Canadian border, we are neighbors with Manitoba. We have two major manufacturers, Marvin Windows and Doors in Warroad, employs about 3,000 people. And Polaris Industries in Roseau employs about 1,700. And then we add our regional healthcare facility, Life Care Medical Center, which employs about 500. There are hundreds of, and I'm not making this up, there are hundreds of jobs available at all of those three, plus our many other related retail stores and suppliers, et cetera. But the greatest barrier we face is a lack of housing. So as an example, Polaris will bring people in from all across the United States for good paying jobs. Marvin has good paying jobs as well. And they'll put them up in a hotel, at least temporarily, for up to 3 months until they can find permanent housing, which, sad to say, generally speaking, does not exist. And so what happens then is those potential employees of Marvin and Polaris and the hospital then move back to wherever they came from, and those companies are not able to fill those positions. The issue that we found here is that private developers don't fill the supply and demand issue. And the reason is fairly simple. They can build an apartment building in the Twin Cities, as an example, and they can charge anywhere between $500 and $1,000 more per month than the market rate in Roseau County. So obviously, if you're them, you're going to go to the place where you can see a quicker return on your investment. So we have had here to do public investment in order to make those kinds of buildings happen. And in fact, we're in the process of building one right now in the city of Roseau that the city of Roseau itself will own. And that's not really the place that local government should be. So the gap funding that has been talked about certainly could encourage private construction, private developers. And I just applaud the fact that you're looking at those issues related to housing, which is different. The need is different here than it is in other parts of Minnesota. So with that, thank you. And I would certainly happily answer any questions that I can answer.
Commissioner, I always appreciate your thoughts and insight on things. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative.
Members, we do have folks from the city and county organizations who are here for questions. They're not here to testify, but you have questions. So Gary Carlson, Patricia Nauman, Matt Hilgert, and Matt Mossman are on the Zoom here. So Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other day you said you had to do your biennial speech on Lost and some of the disparities that are created or inequities that are created from it. And I'm going to ask you to indulge me because I'm going to give you my housing speech that I've given before, and I'm going to restate it again. Representative Howard, you're going in a direction which is very well intentioned. I, too, in 2018 offered a bill that was very similar, very parallel to what you're proposing to do with a different funding source, and it mostly was tied to the archaic mortgage registration tax and state deed tax that this state does not need to charge. Members, I've been in the housing business for 35 years. Nobody wants to build a house more than a builder. And the easiest thing to do to build a house is to keep the price down. But government, in its good intentions, whether at the state or at the local or at the county, have made it difficult to keep housing affordable. And I won't go into it. I could talk for an hour on the input costs of what goes into a house and what makes it expensive. But today, we continue to go down a need. We have to address the need, but I think we're going about it in a wrong direction. And over a generation, I have seen the continuation of our good intentions of helping and helping, creating more and more and more subsidized housing. We call it now workforce housing, but it's still subsidized housing. But what we're doing is we're subsidizing businesses. We're subsidizing businesses so they can pay substandard wages because people have a place to live. This has been a wrong policy for a generation. And furthermore, it reduces competition for business, which would keep prices down and make it better for all consumers. So I'm trying to point out that this has been an incremental thing over decades, over the last many decades. To give you in contrast, the very first home I built was in Plymouth, Minnesota. And I bought a lot there, curb and gutter, $16,000 in Plymouth, Minnesota. And on that $16,000 lot, I made a house, which was a nice split level home in about 1,150 square feet, very typical of what a lot of families live in. And that house sold for $84,000. And we have continued to make it more expensive. Just keep passing on and put it in the price of a home. After World War II, we probably had the largest middle class this country has seen. And since that time, it has gradually diminished to where there is a smaller middle class. And I acknowledge that. We see that in housing. Today, we look at entry-level housing as being $350,000 to $400,000 for a single-family detached home. Now, Commissioner Swanson mentioned about the desire of people to build the apartments in the city. Well, that's true to a certain degree because the three rules of real estate are location, location, location. And you certainly want to go or build where there's a market to sell your product. But conversely, the land cost to build that apartment in St. Paul or Minneapolis or in a first or second suburban ring is substantially different than it's going to be in Roseau County, Minnesota. And land has been one of the biggest drivers, particularly here in the metro. And if you want to look at the region where 60% of the population lives, and if you're trying to address the disparities in housing here, we've had a regional body that has been controlling land use and land growth over all of the cities, which has made land expensive. If you were to buy a lot in the Wayzata School District right now, good luck finding one for under $200,000 just for the lot. And in order to get mortgage appraisals to work and to get a mortgage on that, where land can't be more than 25 or 30% of the cost of a home, that drives it to a $600,000 to $800,000 home. That's the problem. And we continue to go down this rabbit hole of making it more expensive from a government perspective. Right now, I've got two development projects that I'm working on, and it's just a myriad of an open checkbook of money just to even review it. Guess what? I'm not paying for that. It's going to be in the cost of the lot. Tens of thousands of dollars of escrows here and there, do this, do that. It's very onerous, and nobody does anything about it. And I've tried for 10 years unsuccessfully in the legislature. So we need to create a more competitive business environment, which is going to allow businesses to pay higher wages and compete for that labor. That's the right direction to be going. And I'm not going to stand in the way and say we don't have a need here. But incrementally, over the last 30 years, we've made the problem worse, not better. Whether it's a smoke detector is a good idea, to then having to have one on every level, then to have one in every bedroom, or have to have an air exchanger, or have to do this or do that. Builders can't build a house the way they want. Government knows better. So Representative Howard, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I know there's been efforts on the housing front to comprehensively look at what needs to be done, but Minnesota is not the place. What we've seen happen now after the great housing recession is the national home builders have moved in here with their corporate dollars and their publicly traded shares of stock and the capital that they generate. They bought up all the land in the Metro Twin City areas, most of it. They optioned it up during the recession. And now if you want to build a house, it's with them. And the small custom home builders, there's been a lot of attrition over the last 15, 20 years. And unfortunately, the consumer loses. So that's my biennial speech, Representative Marquardt. And thank you for allowing me to air my opinion on this. But I know we need to do things, but we really ought to comprehensively look at just getting the heck out of the way and let the market fix itself. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hertaus. Representative Howard, did you want to respond now or did you want to wait till closing statements?
I can wait, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for hearing this bill, Representative Howard. Sometimes the market doesn't work and we have to intervene to step in. And a lot of our testifiers were explaining that. I am particularly interested in trying to fill that gap funding, like you said, and getting these projects off the ground. And maybe Mr. Frafke, and I apologize, I probably said your name wrong, City Administrator from St. Peter, you had mentioned that gap funding and had also mentioned, and did I hear you right, that one of the housing projects had to have 13 different housing streams to get it off the ground?
Mr. Prafke?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's correct. We had a single family housing project, a subdivision that the city developed. The city financed the infrastructure, put in the water, sewer, roadway, sidewalks, all those things. We built half of the homes within that subdivision, so about 40 homes. And that project had 13 different funding sources to make that work out for end housing or home buyers. All within, whether you like the terminology or not, workforce housing. So these are people that are school teachers and mechanics and electricians, and that's who that housing supports. And so this does get to be very complicated very quickly, but there are gaps that are still present that these types of resources could help fill.
Chair Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Frafke, and thank you, Chair. Yes, I actually took a small webinar that just gave me a tiny taste through ULI and how they put performance together for affordable housing, and that gap funding is real. And that's one of the things that we can do in partnership with our cities and counties to help with that gap funding. And I think it's very important that we do, because we're getting to a crisis point in housing when you have 25% of folks all over the state that are not able to afford their housing, and some up to 56% cost burden, according to the slides from the Minnesota Housing Project. So thank you, Representative Howard.
Thank you, Chair Joaquin. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hertaus, I think you gave a great summarized version of your dissertation. I couldn't agree more, so I won't repeat that stuff, but what he said really bears worth noting. Here in the state of Minnesota, me coming from other states before I moved here, housing in Minnesota is outrageously expensive compared to other states. And the further I investigated, the further I realized we're the ones that are causing that problem, not the market. What I do want to touch on, Mr. Chair, is when I'm back home, I tell people we kind of throw tens of millions and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars around here like it's tossed salad. And these numbers can be pretty stunning. And so I feel like there needs to be a bit of sobriety here. This is $100 million a year. I had staff quickly look up, and just this year, LGA is $570 million. And I know that there's a bill going around. I haven't seen it, or if I did, I forgot that I saw it, but I think there's a request for $97 million more in LGA, and that doesn't include state county aid. That doesn't include special funding for schools, which are in the communities. That doesn't include stuff through deed. I think that if Minnesota is saying that we can't afford to live in a town in Minnesota, we need to have a broader conversation. Because if there's all this money needed just in order to live in a town in Minnesota, which is being recirculated by the people that live in Minnesota because this is taxpayer money, we have a major, major problem if we're saying that we can't live in Minnesota if the state doesn't tax people. I don't understand where we've turned the corner where it's the responsibility of government to give people housing. That's what they do in socialist European countries and communist countries. Now, are there circumstances where maybe the empowerment of the state, you know, enables certain things? Sure, but we just keep going further and further down this road of let's just throw a bunch of money and then we have people say, well, we can't afford to build a house unless we get this money from the taxpayer. Which is the people trying to live in that house. The reference of Representative Hertas of living wages being suppressed by this, that's exactly what's happening. I've seen this happen in most pronounced in Wilmer, which is not in my district, but it's right by. And the working conditions are predicated exactly off of this stuff. I just, again, well-intentioned as people have said, but for us to just continue to throw more and more money at this and somehow it's going to fix something. If we have this big of a problem, we need to address this in a bigger way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman. My apologies. Representative Howard, thank you for bringing this bill forward. You know, I think you have a bill here that you're proposing to use public funds to expand supply and lower housing costs. And those are admirable goals. I think the concern you're hearing from our side of the aisle is that government simultaneously is also spending money to reduce supply and increase housing costs. And so we're using public funds to engage in a tug of war. And that's what the frustration you're hearing here from many members. So I want to just thank you for bringing the bill forward, because what we are facing in our housing supply issue, this is a serious problem. Not only for upward mobility and economic development, but just the health of our region. So thanks for bringing that forward. But just do realize the frustration you're hearing from our side, right? Because government right now is spending money to do the exact opposite of what it is you're attempting to achieve in your bill right now. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Howard, final thoughts on House File 3982 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers and to the members for a really good discussion. I think what I want to highlight is where there's agreement in this committee, and that our state is challenged in so many ways by our housing crisis, and that we will not reach our potential, whether we're talking about our economic strength, whether we're talking about narrowing racial gaps in our schools, of economics, of health. We will not reach our potential as a state unless we meet this moment of our housing crisis. And what I hope is persuasive to members is hearing from leaders all across the state that know this issue backwards and forwards. I really listened to Mr. Prafke's testimony, and it dawns on me every time I hear from one of our economic development directors or HRA directors, just how incredibly complex it is to put together a deal to move forward this development. And we have incredibly smart, committed leaders all across our state that are telling us we can do this, but we need a partner, we need resources. And that's what this bill will do. And just lastly, to the notion of kind of the regulatory issue or whether we should just kind of let the market take its course. I think it's fair to have some of those conversations about regulatory issues, but I think if you really look at this issue, there is no way we are going to address our housing crisis without significant investment. The market is not working to build the kinds of housing that matches the needs of our communities. And the reality is there's no silver bullet. we need to kind of be in yes and mode. But I think the balance of the evidence suggests that the number one thing that we can do is make the investments we need to meet the housing challenges all across our state. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I thank everyone for the discussion and encourage support of the bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Howard and members for your discussion this year. Last year, with Representative Gomez's leadership, we established a homeless aid to counties at about $20 million a year for the next 6 years. And so, I mean, as we all have talked about, housing is a big need. So thank you for bringing this forward. And the chair will lay over House File 3982 as amended. Thank you. Representative Detmer, I had mentioned at the beginning of the meeting I would call on you for the minutes, and I forgot the minutes. Representative Detmer, are you ready to approve the March 10th minutes?
Mr. Chair and members, I move the committee minutes for Thursday, March 10th, 2022.
Thank you very much, Representative Detmer. Any discussion on that motion? If not, I'm going to ask you to temporarily unmute yourself to vote on approval of the March 10th, 2022 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The motion does prevail. The March 10th, 2022 are approved. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have House File 3754. Chair Davids, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to, Mr. Chairman, like to move House File 3754. And then I have an amendment I'd also like to move.
Would you please move that?
Yes, I'll move the amendment. What the amendment does, members, is it adds in with the professional sports team of the University of Minnesota.
Very good. So the A1 amendment is moved by Chair Davids. Any discussion on that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Chair Davids, to the bill as amended.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill does, 3754, is it tries to clear some things up that are already extremely clear in statute. But we have the department has seemed to gone awry from what we did previously. I think it was the 2017 tax bill, whatever tax bill was, where we fixed this issue, and now for some reason it's back before us. Members, the teams are currently paying taxes, so the fiscal impact should be minimal and would cancel out over time. The teams are at the legislature to clarify that we will continue to pay sales tax on tickets at the time of event, which is has been the intention of the legislature. It's in law, and for some reason the department is having issues with that. The other issue here that I'm concerned about is the teams will continue to pay the sales tax on food and beverages when the food and beverages are purchased. The bill language would clarify that so that teams are not doubly taxed, so that they're taxed when they're purchased and then when they are in the suite. It seems the department has quite a time getting this one figured out. I think the work we did, whatever year it was very clear, but they seem to be going around some of this, and we just want to clear it up, and this should be quite non-controversial. It's kind of one of those bills, Mr. Chairman, we say, okay, it's the law, but this bill says, we really mean what the law says. And so I hope we can clear that up. I do have a testifier, and then we will stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much, Chair David. So we have Kate Chabilsky, Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Vikings, and also available for questions, Pete Steen, CFO with Minnesota Timberwolves, and Kip Elliott, CFO with the Minnesota Twins. So Kate Chabilsky, if you would introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Welcome. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
So my name is Kate Chabilsky. I'm the CFO of the Minnesota Vikings. As mentioned, I have Kip and Pete here from the Twins and the Timberwolves, respectively, and then Jeff from the Minnesota Wild was not able to join today, but he's been involved in these ongoing conversations as well. So as Representative Davids noted, I mean, there's three issues that are as part of this amendment, all really what we're going to kind of consider clarifications or technical corrections. So the first one relates to an issue we aligned on back in 2017. So the statute is intended to separate a ticket portion from a suite license from the real estate portion. So obviously when you go to a suite, you're in your own box, and a portion of that cost is considered real estate. So the ticket is still taxable as the privilege of admission, but the real estate would be exempt, as sales tax obviously doesn't generally apply to real estate tax or to real estate. So unfortunately now the department is trying to refer to the sale of a suite as a bundled transaction, which is then suggesting that the 2017 exemption for real estate is irrelevant. So this amendment would just allow us to stay true to that alignment we had in 17 and treat the real estate piece as not taxable. The second piece is a similar issue, but also kind of brings in our premium seating. So for suites or premium seating that include amenities such as food and beverage or parking, we pay tax on those amenities to the various providers. So an Airmark or a Levy or anyone who provides parking, the team pays directly to those providers. And then in 2017, again, we were aligned that the ticket price is taxable. But now the department is coming and saying that we also need to charge our customers sales tax on the food and beverage. So what that results on is to use food here, the same, the hot dog is being double taxed. It's being taxed once when we would have to charge our customers for the hot dog, and then when we pay the concessionaire for the same hot dog. So this amendment would just to kind of allow that deduction for the sales tax already paid to a vendor, which eliminates that double taxation. And then the third issue is probably the biggest that we want to kind of give some context to. So since the beginning of all of our teams, we've been accounting for ticket sales on the accrual basis, which is consistent with both federal income tax, state income tax, as well as what we've been doing for sales tax. So we remit sales tax when the game is played. And this aligns with our internal process, the ticketing systems, and ensures that the remittance reconciles to the final seating payments. So for instance, when a game is canceled or if someone requests a refund or they switch games and they upgrade, we remit payment when the game's actually played. So we know who was there, how much they spent. And that again, reconciles to all of our internal systems. And we've actually worked with department over the last, for me, 15 to 20 years to ensure that the schedules we provide make for a consistent and efficient audit. So unfortunately, as mentioned, the department has recently indicated that they're changing their interpretation and requests that we remit sales tax as the ticket payments are collected. So this, number one, causes a significant administrative burden that would essentially require a separate set of books for the sole purpose of Minnesota sales tax. When really the tax is collected over the season or the year, there's no change in tax due. And then from another practical standpoint, when there is a refund, right, like a customer has paid us for the ticket, we have to refund them. We've already paid the tax to the department. So in order to get that tax back, they're adding another administrative burden for us to go and request that, which doesn't allow us or wouldn't allow us to provide the customer back the full refund until we were to collect the refund back from the state. So the most obvious example was COVID, but another real example is what the Twins are dealing with this year with a couple of the canceled games. So there's multiple examples of that administrative burden. And as a point of emphasis, I just want to bring up, and I think each of our teams are under audit this year and we're all at different points, but every single one of our audit teams has requested us to calculate the assessment. They're not able to calculate what that assessment would be with our current systems and our current processes. And we agree with them. We aren't able to calculate it because that's not how we do business, or nor have we done business for the last several years since the beginning of all of our teams. So this amendment really would ensure the consistency of the accounting methods with the tax methods and confirm the current law and practices. I know I'm short on time here, but I do want to address the fiscal note that was issued this morning. I think there's two points of clarification that I'm not sure are reflected in there most accurately. So the first one is related to the food and beverage. We are not suggesting that the food and beverage is not taxable. There's not a request for an exemption. We're just suggesting that hot dog should only be taxed once versus twice. And then the second piece is in the gross receipts. I think what's not reflected in there is the offset in a year. So this is just a timing issue. If it were to even be a shift, again, I think the discussion is we've done it this way forever. So there's not really a shift because it just would confirm what we're currently doing. But if there would be a shift, I think what the fiscal note is missing is that offset in either prior or subsequent tax year. So again, happy to take questions or provide additional context, but want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and everyone on this call for your time today.
Ms. Schabelsky, thank you so much. And let me just read what it is. The revenue estimate is mentioned, and we can have also the Department of Revenue address this if they want. But for 2023, it's $19.32 million, and then in 24, it's $1.78 million, and in 2025, $1.82 million. And I see we've got members with their hands up, but I think we're going to hear from the Department of Revenue, so it might guide your questions, and then you can, if that's okay with, I see nodding of heads, so let's do that first. So we have Joanna Bears from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Welcome to the committee, and if you would introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bears, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I also have our attorney, Dexter Wilson, online with me as well for questions, and he can speak to more to the bundling transaction if there's questions about that piece. I just want to provide a brief testimony about how sales taxes are administered at the department. As you all know, sales taxes are trust taxes, which means the tax is paid by the customer, and the retailer collects that tax on behalf of the state and then reports and remits the tax collected to the state. The sale and purchase of a privilege of admission to places of amusement, recreational areas, or athletic events have been subject to sales tax since the inception of sales tax in 1967. And since this is a privilege that is the taxable event, not the event itself, the tax is collected at the time the admission is sold, not when the event occurs. Once the tax is collected from the customer, it becomes a debt owed to the state of Minnesota and by the retailer, and the retailer must hold it in trust for the state until it's remitted. Any tax collected, even illegally or erroneously, are state funds and must be reported and remitted as required by state law. And generally, retailers must remit and report tax collected on the 20th day of the month following the month of sale. Some small retailers are required to submit quarterly and some even annually. If the event is canceled and the retailer issues a refund to the customer, they must refund their customer, including the tax. The retailer can net this on their next month's return or may apply directly to the Department of Revenue for a sales tax refund. How and under what circumstances a retailer refunds the sale is up to the seller. This approach Minnesota uses for a collection of remittance sales tax is the same approach most states use when they collect and remit sales taxes. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take any questions that people have.
So, Ms. Bears, before we move on, there was a talk about double taxation on that hot dog. Is there double taxation on the hot dog, Ms. Bears?
Mr. Chair, members, no, there's not. And actually, Dexter Wilson is on the line. Maybe he can explain a little bit how that works.
I would like that part addressed, because I don't think so. Mr. Wilson?
Chair Marquardt, members of the committee, can you hear me? Not seeing my.
You can. Thank you.
All right. Oh, I'm Dexter Wilson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. On this issue of double taxation, it said that the product, the inputs to a sale are taxable, and the sale of the privilege of admission is also taxable. So if a product is not separately stated, then it's unclear, you know, what amount of that, or actually under statute, the privilege of admission includes these amenities. So what we have is the food is purchased subject to tax, and it is not purchased for purpose of resale because it's not later resold. Instead, it's included in this privilege of admission. So we have the product, which is the input, being subject to tax. Then we have the separate product, which is a privilege of admission, being subject to tax.
But, okay, so, all right. So, but if the hot dog is purchased later, is it taxed again? Or is it, I mean, if it's part of the admission, Mr. Wilson, but then and it's taxed at that point, all the amenities. They mm-hmm. then buy a hot dog when they're in the suite. Is that taxed again?
The privilege of admission would be subject to tax again, or tax once. It'd be different, for example, if they sold the hot dog and you purchased the hot dog at the concession stand.
Right.
That hot dog would be purchased exempt because it's purchased for the purpose of resale. Then at the concession stand, you give, you know, so many dollars, and in return you receive that hot dog and you pay sales tax at just that step. If it was included in the price of the privilege of admission, that would be a different case because you wouldn't be receiving consideration directly for that hot dog. That would just be included in the privilege of admission. It would be similar to an example where if you were to purchase soap at a convenience store, you'd pay sales tax on that purchase of the soap. If you were a hotel and you purchased soap that you were going to include in your rooms, you would pay sales tax on the purchase of that soap. But when you purchase the sale of your lodging, that would still be also subject to sales tax. But you may be entitled to take that soap from the hotel.
Okay. So, well, let's go to questions. So, Representative, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Representative Miller.
Sorry about that. My mute button didn't click off right away. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, testifiers. Ms. Shabilsky, there's always names that I don't know why we can't just have Smiths testify. We never seem to. So if I said your name wrong, I apologize. A quick question for you. I was privileged actually a couple of years ago. Probably shouldn't say this as a politician, but I actually went to a suite at the Minnesota Vikings one game on the Medtronics level. So they have the restaurant there. People haven't been there. It's a beautiful place. You have the food, not only in the suite, but behind and stuff like that. And I'm sure that the people that lease, I think that's the right term, or purchase or whatever it is, these suites, they pay quite a bit of money. If you were to isolate it down to one of those suites, if I was a company that came in and purchased the rights to this suite, about how much money would that company save in taxes if they were to get this benefit? Because as we know, it passes through to the end consumer. So about how much for that suite would they save in taxes if they weren't double taxed for their hot dogs?
Ms. Shabilsky.
So yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm following your question, but I think so on average, the 14% is the tax rate on a all-inclusive offering, which would include the food and beverage.
Representative Miller?
Mr. Chair, so that would be 14% on, maybe this isn't a simple number, but just I get a suite, about how much is that for a season?
Got it.
Ms. Shabilsky, yeah, there you go.
Oh, sorry. I hear what you're saying now. So yeah, I would say, so to use rough numbers, let's just use $100 per game is the value of food and beverage. So they'd be, in that example, saying $14 per game on that example.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Shabilsky. I won't continue to ask questions. Mr. Chair, I do have to say that to be consistent and show some integrity, I hear a $19.3 million bill on this. I've been saying give it all back from the beginning of this session. And if we start giving pieces to different organizations and stuff like that, I appreciate Representative Davids. You're a friend of mine, and I hope I am after I say this, but I can't support a bill like this when we're talking about a suite at a Minnesota Vikings or Minnesota Twins game. It's inherent with the cost that you are going to be paying a premium on what you do. And it just seems like this is really kind of fractioning down, trying to find a little bit of savings here, a little bit of savings there that I don't know that is even going to be passed along to the company anyway. In the priority of bills and taxes this year, I understand if this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, but I would ask the chair in this committee to consider this a lower priority at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to first, you know, Representative Miller, I want to talk to you more about this, but there's a reason that we don't just have people named Smith in front of our committees. And it's really important that we create a welcoming environment for everyone in our communities. And I know that you were making a joke, but I want us to just talk a little bit more about that, you know, later. Like I said, you know, we're buddies, so we can deal with that between us. But I just wanted to say that, like, you know, I think that certain people's names are like hard to pronounce for people, but it's like we need to create a space where all Minnesotans are welcome to come in front of our committees and testify, and we will respectfully welcome them and, you know, and learn their names. I also agree with a lot of what you just said. This is just really fascinating. I don't know if our chair constructed today's hearing with this in mind, but today is really the tale of two tax expenditures. You know, we started with Representative Howard's bill, which is designed to help the way that he, you know, really smartly, I think, designed the allocation formula for his affordable housing aid to local counties was based on the metric of cost burden, which means people who are paying, you know, more than 30% of their income on housing. And this is a problem. We have tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, I believe, across the state who are in that situation, who are having to make the decision, am I going to pay my rent? Or am I going to, can I put the light bill off for a couple of weeks? What happens if you have a, you know, an unexpected car repair? It's like we have people in our communities who are really living on the edge of true economic precarity. And then we have a proposal to spend $20 million to subsidize stadium suites for the Minnesota Vikings, owned by a billionaire, you know, a stadium that I live in Minneapolis. I'm paying for that amenity, right? Which serves mostly to increase the net worth of the out-of-state billionaire that owns it. And so, you know, we have decisions to make as guardians of the public budget and the public good. And we, you know, we have to make decisions. To think that we would spend $20 million to subsidize stadium suites for the wealthiest among us, when that's literally the amount that our chair had to fight to get $20 million a year for homeless kids last year, right? Let's be very serious about what this is in front of us. So nobody will be surprised, but this is why we have a tax expenditure commission, especially to deal with giveaways like this to the wealthiest among us, when we have unfinished business in all of our communities, when we have schools that are underfunded, where we have hourly employees who are making poverty wages, when we don't have adequate mental health supports in our schools, when folks are going homeless in our communities, when people cannot afford health care, the idea that we would spend tens of millions of dollars to subsidize luxury box suites and the, you know, alcohol and food and parking that go along with it is just, it does not reflect the values that I know that we share, that we hold in common. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Swazinski. And then I'm going to go to Chair Davids for the last words on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Swazinski. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of to finish up. So, you know, as this moves forward, so this is it's not my understanding that this is a new proposal. This is just actually clarifying what is actually should be law in the way it's being interpreted. Am I correct with that?
Well, that certainly is, I think, the intention of the bill. Yes,
Representative. Sounds good. As a member who has a unique last name, Representative Gomez, you know, sometimes that's just life. I don't know if you could say my last name or not, but it's sometimes difficult for folks.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
Oh. Anything further, Representative Swazinski?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Chair Davids, you have the floor on House File 3754 as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure what bill my good friend Representative Gomez was even talking about. The $19 million is not a tax break for the class warfare richest among us. It's a timing issue. I'd like to just ask representative of the Department of Commerce here, Department of Revenue here, will the department, because of this bill, get $19 million more? Or, will the department, if things are left as is, get $19 million more?
So, Ms. Bears, there's some questions on the revenue estimate. Can you clarify that?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
And I know Cynthia Templin also, maybe either one. So maybe, is Cynthia Templin, Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, the gross receipts reporting, the change from accrual accounting to the cash-based accounting creates a one-time shift in fiscal 23, and it is a one-time shift that would at a cost of $17.130 million in fiscal 23. And what it does, it just shifts the payment into fiscal 23. And then the additional cost in the tails is the difference in the in growth in the collection of sales tax receipts, the difference between current law and the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the department, why the change all of a sudden? You're obeying the law as it was written, and all of a sudden you're changing the middle of the game. So to Representative Miller's comments, I mean, this isn't about $19 million for rich people. This is about consistency following the law. And the department seems lately to have a very, very tough time doing that, whether it be pipelines, whether it be boxes on electric poles, or whatever the issue is. My question to Ms. Bears is, why the switch now? Why are you doing this now? Why aren't we following the previous law as it is written?
So, Ms. Bears, what is the interpretation now of the Department of Revenue, and why is there this perceived change?
Chair Marquardt, Representative Davids, I just want to add one thing about the revenue estimate. It does say it also expands the exemption to amenities included. So there's also a price in our revenue estimate on that, if you look under what the proposed law does on that piece. We have not changed any law at the department that would impact this type of area recently. So we are happy, Representative Davids, to come talk to you a little bit more about it, since I know we are running out of time in committee, but there's nothing that's recently been changed that would impact this type of law.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to Ms. Bears, why is it scored differently in the Senate? They seem to have it right. We don't. The department doesn't seem to have it right.
Ms. Templin, can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I received information from the Department of Revenue that the Senate's revenue estimate, there was an error in that, and that they will be publishing a corrected revenue estimate for the Senate companion as amended.
Okay.
And Chair Davidson, we have like 2 minutes on this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much. And again, members, this is not about a tax break for the wealthy. This is about holding the department accountable for doing their job correctly, not shifting in the middle of the game. That's what this is about. And I hope Representative Miller and Representative Gomez, we can still be friends, because if we couldn't, that could cause me more pain than my heart could bear. But members, it really bothers me when the department's going to double tax my hot dog and my Diet Mountain Dew. So with that, it's a good bill. It's a shift. It's not tax breaks for anybody. So please read the bill. And just hold the department accountable to do their job. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Davids. And so, I mean, I think there is more we need to look at this. I think it's a matter of interpretation. And, I think maybe we need to go offline and talk about this a little bit further and see where this kind of this difference in interpretation really is. So with that, thank you. Chair Davids, for bringing this forward. Thank you, members. The chair will lay over House File 3754 as amended. So, members, we have four bills tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we have a number of bills on exempting sales tax on local units of government construction. And so that's, I think we've got six or seven bills on Thursday. So with that, Representative McDonald, very quickly, you've got like 10 seconds.
You got it. Thanks, Mr. Chair. See, I was just wondering if I have a bill that reduces the tax rate, in personal income tax rate. Can I get a hearing on that?
Representative McDonald, your bill will receive consideration as all other bills that come before this illustrious taxes committee.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. With that, members, we are adjourned.